4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back on Monday. Coming up, there are now 3 confirmed cases of avian flu in the state. We'll take a look at what's being done to stem the spread of the disease and how it's affecting the poultry business in Wisconsin. First, it's time for a weekly review of state news with news guy Noah Ovshinsky. The state's Joint Finance Committee met this week to vote on proposals in the state budget. They'll spend the next few weeks reviewing that budget, and we'll cover what changes they've made so far. Also, a new Marquette poll came out this week showing Governor Walker has a 41% approval rating among state voters, the lowest rating since they started the poll. WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky joins us now to bring us up to speed on these stories. Noah, welcome as always.
It is good to be here on this absolutely beautiful afternoon.
It's nice out there, a bit stuffy and warm here in the studio. Well, let's take a look at this new Marquette poll. Haven't seen one of these, since before the elections, right?
Yeah, this is the first poll from them since October, so it's been several months. And it's certainly been a poll that I think those of us who follow the news have been highly anticipating.
Right, and this comes in the middle of budget season.
It does, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's so interesting. We're in the middle of this ongoing debate over Governor Walker's budget, and for context, as we talk about this poll, it represents the opinions of 800 registered voters in Wisconsin.
All right, so the budget, this broke down parts of the budget. What do Wisconsinites think about what's in there?
The takeaway, the headline, if you will, is that most Wisconsinites are not happy with this budget.
So let's tackle a couple of the line items that have been in the news, and that's why they were obviously asked about in this edition of the Marquette poll.
Right. So one of the things that they were asked about is the size of the cuts, both the cuts to the UW system that are proposed and the cuts to K-12 education. 78% don't like the $127 million cut to K-12 schools. 18% support it. The cuts to the UW, 70% oppose the cuts, and we're talking about a $300 million cut. Only 26% support the cut. So, vast majorities, not liking these cuts.
And these have been some of the headline items since that budget came out. And these are things that might be, and we'll get into this in a minute, but these might be some of the toughest items for lawmakers to wrangle on through.
Right. Absolutely. And, in some sense, the Joint Finance Committee right now, they've been dealing with, I'll call them sort of low-hanging fruit. But once we get to these big cuts, then the rubber really meets the road with the legislature, depending on what they do.
And as I mentioned up front, this also asked about the governor's approval rating in the state.
Right. And so we're in budget time. And if you look at his approval rating, it's declined quite a bit since last October. It currently stands at 41% in October, right around election time, it was 49%. So it is down 8%.
Okay. And in addition to that poll, the governor did fairly well in the election. He's still the governor, of course. So any idea of why the slippage in the poll?
Well, pollster Charles Franklin, who's behind the Marquette poll, says there are actually a few things putting downward pressure on his approval rating.
Well, I think when you look at reactions to the state budget items, where most items have substantial opposition to cuts, more pessimism about the state budget being worse off than it was, the jobs picture, and the state being on the wrong track, all of those together conspire to create a more negative view of the state right now, coupled with his presidential travels and the fact that he's not here, if you will, campaigning for his budget and campaigning for his role as governor, then those pressures all push against his job approval rating.
Interesting point that he's not here making the active case for his budget while it's been under fire, including from his own party. Have we heard from the governor since this poll came out yesterday?
Yes, the governor actually held a phone call with reporters yesterday from Europe, where he is on a trade mission. When asked about the poll numbers, he said the budget was most likely responsible for the drop. But he thinks his numbers will improve.
I think when people in the end, in June, once the budget's completed and we've signed it and all those other pods are out there, I think they'll have a significant change. We saw that in 4 years ago, when not just with the budget, but overall. I mean, 4 years ago at this time, I think Time Magazine called me Dead Man Walker, so that most people didn't think I'd make a recall, let again a reelection. But in September, when schools went back and the schools were the same or better, in December when property taxes were down for the first time in, I think, a dozen years, suddenly people's opinions started to change, and I think this will be true here.
As Governor Walker there, as we talk to Noah Ovchinsky about some of the top stories of the week, talking about the Marquette survey right now. Governor Walker's trip to Europe is being viewed in part in the lens of him likely running for president. We heard Charles Franklin mention that run for the White House. Did the poll tackle that issue, the presidential campaign?
It did, at least one potential matchup in this upcoming presidential election. In a theoretical matchup between Hillary Clinton, who just recently announced that she's running, and Scott Walker, this poll has Clinton really handily beating Walker in Wisconsin. Among eligible voters, 52% say they would support Clinton, 40% would support Walker.
Of course, that hypothetical matchup, a long way off, a lot can change. They always say the polls are a snapshot in time. Well, one more budget issue that was surveyed in the poll, financing for a new arena for the Milwaukee Bucks and related activities. What did the poll find?
So, and this is one of the things also, beyond the cuts to the UW and K-12 education, this is something else that's been hotly debated in the governor's budget. The idea of the state borrowing money to help pay for it, according to this poll, is very, very unpopular. And in this case, we're talking about Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald's plan that would have the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands helping pay for this new arena, something to the tune of about $150 million. When asked about this financing plan, 79% oppose it, only 17% support it. So a lot of people, probably thinking that taxpayer money should not be going to this arena, at least not in the form of bonds.
All right. And in addition to the budget, the presidential race, the poll looked at the Senate race in 2016.
So, yeah, again, another hypothetical matchup. The poll matched up Senator Ron Johnson against former Senator Russ Feingold, who is looking like he might run again for his old seat. The poll had Feingold with a 54-38% lead over Johnson. So quite a significant lead there for Feingold in this hypothetical matchup.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on. Joint Finance, we touched on this earlier, got into some action with the governor's budget. It's going to go on for a while, probably some highlights there.
Right. So this week was really the round one in this budget battle that will last probably at least through June. The committee dropped 13 policy provisions that were actually in the governor's budget. They include the governor's plan to strip power from the Natural Resources Board. That has been removed, and that was a very controversial idea within the Republican caucus itself. So not surprising that that was dropped. They dropped a plan to transfer assessment responsibilities from municipalities to counties. The committee also removed a provision that would have made UW research exempt from the state's open records law. And finally, for those who rack up traffic violations, they should be celebrating the committee's decision not to include in the governor's plan that he wanted to increase fines for some of these minor violations. And so the committee voting against that fine increase.
And one more item, the Judicial Commission. What is that? What changed there for the Joint Finance Committee?
So, yeah, the JFC departed with the governor on the issue of the Judicial Commission. The governor wanted to essentially strip it of its independence and put it under the Supreme Court. And just as a reminder, the commission actually investigates claims against judges and lawyers in the state. The JFC declined to do that, to follow the governor's wishes on that. They felt it was important to keep this commission an independent body so that the Supreme Court itself could be held accountable, because under the governor's plan, it would be the Supreme Court in which this commission would be under.
Okay, a lot of no's there. What did they say yes to on the governor's budget?
The committee agreed with the governor and ended up cutting the Secretary of State's staff and voted to move him out of a rented space. This was something Doug LaFollette was obviously against. He called the move a train wreck. But the vote really, it caps a long-running effort to strip the position of power. And this is, again, one of those areas where the governor and the legislature were largely on the same page.
As you mentioned earlier, this is a lot of low-hanging fruit. What are the biggies that we're watching for in the coming weeks and months, for that matter?
Exactly. So the biggies that we'll be waiting for include the decision to largely bond to pay for roads and construction, a very controversial idea, the $300 million billion cut to the UW, the $120 million-plus cut to K-12, and finally, changes to long-term care that the governor's proposing. Those have also been controversial. We're waiting to see what happens with those with the Joint Finance Committee.
We will be talking to you about these very items in the weeks to come. Noah, thanks as always.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovchinsky going over some of the biggest stories around the state in our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Three confirmed cases of bird flu have hit Wisconsin. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced the first on Monday. Two more confirmed later in the week. They include a commercial chicken flock, a commercial turkey flock, and a backyard flock of mixed birds. Canada and countries in the European Union have already stopped importing poultry from the state. Plans are underway to euthanize hundreds of thousands of birds to stop the spread. Here with us is University of Wisconsin Extension Poultry Specialist Ron Kane. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And I'll invite listeners, if you have questions about the bird flu outbreak, join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. First, Ron, do we know how this avian flu spread to Wisconsin?
Well, we're fairly certain that wild waterfowl, wild ducks and geese carried this type, and so it's assumed that they are transmitting it, you know, up the Midwest Flyway. It's a little less certain how it's getting inside the barns in some situations, but I think that's probably they are the base at some point.
So these migrating birds, the disease, as I understand it, doesn't necessarily affect them, but they can carry it.
Correct.
So what are the details of the outbreak? What have we seen this week?
So the farms, as I understand it, have all seen fairly high mortality, so lots of dead birds. And then they call in USDA and Department of Agriculture here in the state, and they have tested positive then. So from that point, they quarantine those facilities and are in the process of euthanizing them.
And how many birds are potentially at risk, and how many are affected by this effort to control this?
So as I understand, the first chicken farm had about 180,000 chickens, and a fair number of those, I believe, have actually died from the disease, but the rest would be euthanized. The turkey flock, I think, was approximately 125,000 turkeys. And so, again, the same situation.
So what is the bird flu? What are the symptoms in chickens and turkeys?
In many cases, the birds just die very suddenly. And so they're finding, you know, dead birds with very few symptoms. In other cases, as I understand it, they get sort of quiet, don't want to move, can't stand up, some things like that. But I believe in a lot of cases, it's a sudden death.
And one question that probably pops in a lot of people's minds, we've seen animal-to-human transmissions of various kinds of flus, including bird flus. This particular one, as far as we know yet, any dangers for humans?
There's no evidence of that. No, no one has gotten sick that anyone has seen, and there's no, as far as we know, it's not affecting any humans.
Now, this week was the first sign of this here in Wisconsin, but when did the outbreak of this bird flu start in the U.S.?
Yeah, it started on the West Coast. I believe in February there were some breaks in California and Oregon and Washington and Idaho, and then first week in March, there was a break here in the Midwest in Minnesota, and since then, sort of up and down the Mississippi River. So Arkansas, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota.
So given that it's been spreading from the West, apparently, were we watching for this here in the state?
Yes, we were definitely aware of it, and I hate to say, but probably expecting it. I think we were afraid that there would be some. So the diagnostic lab and Department of Agriculture and USDA and everyone has been sort of monitoring things.
I want to get into the scope of this. How much of an impact is this having on the poultry business in states it's already been in, potentially here in Wisconsin?
Sure. I would say so far it's been fairly minimal on an industry scale. You know, it sounds like a lot of chickens, but in reality it's a fairly small number. Turkeys, I believe it's affected approximately 1% of the annual turkey production. So not a huge thing, but potentially it could be a big problem.
So for a particular farm affected, even if it's 1% of the whole, if it's 100% of your flock, that's a big impact.
It's devastating for them, yes. You know, and an emotional toll as well. I think it's really a struggle for them to deal with this.
We are talking about this outbreak of an avian flu affecting chickens and turkeys, first seen in Wisconsin now this week. Ron Kane is with us from UW Extension. On the consumer side, Ron, with the scope you just talked about, are consumers going to see any difference in prices and availability of poultry products?
I think, again, currently, I don't think there will be a large effect. Certainly, you know, it hasn't hit enough maybe to cause a problem, but I think we don't know what's coming. You know, potentially it could get worse. There's concern in the East Coast. Of course, there's a lot of broiler production there, so if this were to spread down the East Coast flyway, then you could see a lot more chicken concerns.
Now that the problem's here, what is the state doing, and along with USDA, to try to make sure it doesn't spread any more than it already has?
Sure. So immediately when there's a confirmed positive, that farm is quarantined. So nothing, you know, no poultry or products can leave that farm. They also put in a containment zone around that farm, and they will test all the birds within that containment zone to see that they don't carry influenza. And then, you know, beyond that, I think just spreading the word and trying to get everyone to tighten biosecurity in hopes that we don't get spread.
So maybe morbid curiosity, but how does one euthanize and then dispose of over, you know, six-digit number of sure, potentially diseased birds?
And there are a couple approved methods. In some cases, they can use a foam. And it's sort of like a firefighting foam that it just like you would suffocate a fire, it sort of removes the oxygen, and so the birds are euthanized that way. Seems like it's fairly humane. The other method is typically a carbon dioxide euthanasia. So, again, it's a chamber, and they would be run out of oxygen.
Now, the USDA told Minnesota, which had already had problems with this, that this bird flu may be around, we're talking years here, about a few years before we're through this. Why are we looking at that long a timeline?
Yeah, I saw that. I think the concern is that since it's in wild waterfowl, it may just be a couple of years of those birds migrating back and forth from north to south and back again. I think the hope is that, you know, in a couple of years, either the virus will mutate, which it does readily, or maybe birds will become a bit more immune to it. But not a rosy outlook.
Now, for people with smaller operations, maybe just you know, a handful of birds on their farm or backyard chicken farmers, any advice to try to keep the disease out of their birds?
Yeah, and again, I think, you know, we all stress biosecurity. Trying to keep some separation from the domestic flocks and wild birds is probably the biggest thing. If you can get the birds indoors, that's probably safest. And then don't have people tracking things, you know, wearing plastic boots or having designated footwear so you don't track bird droppings into your flock can be a big thing. I think those are probably the keys.
Now, county fairs are just a few months off. 4-H members are looking forward to showing off animals. Are we going to see extra precautions, changes in the way animals are brought and exhibited at fairs?
From what I understand at this point, there are not any rules changes planned. That's coming from the Department of Agriculture, but I don't believe they're planning anything at this point. Now, if things get worse, maybe. Definitely, I would encourage, you know, again, strict biosecurity. We always encourage them to quarantine their birds after the fair before they mix them back with their flock. That's probably will be stressed a lot more this year. And I don't know. I hope that, again, once the migration passes through, maybe things will calm down. So by June, July, hopefully this will pass.
Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Have a good day.
We've been speaking with UW Extension poultry specialist Ron Kane, looking at the three cases of bird flu that have hit Wisconsin, what it means for chickens and turkeys and the people who raise them here in the state. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard will be back with me on Monday. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is back on Monday. Last week, the interim CEO of the internet company Reddit announced that it's going to stop negotiating salaries with potential hires. The change is an effort to help close the wage gap for women who CEO Ellen Pao says are more likely to fall behind men in salary negotiations. Instead, Reddit says it'll offer what is fair. The move has drawn praise and criticism. It could represent a shift in hiring practices if it turns out to be successful. Lily Garcia joins us now. She's an employment attorney with nearly 20 years of experience advising clients, primarily in the high-tech and education sectors. Lily, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Rob.
So how radical a move is this to stop negotiating salaries with potential hires at this high-tech online company?
You know, Rob, it's drawn a lot of positive attention, but from my perspective as an employment attorney and HR professional, it's simply an HR policy decision not to negotiate salaries. So it comes at a point in time where Ellen Pao is getting a lot of attention because of her recent lawsuit, and she's certainly become a champion for the cause of the equality of women in the workplace. But I don't see this as something enormously radical.
So can you explain the thinking behind the move? Ellen Pao at Reddit is making the case that if we get rid of negotiations here, it's going to help equalize pay between men and women doing the same job. What's the connection there?
It very well may do that, and it may do that for her company. What it does is it eliminates a negotiation advantage. So the research certainly supports the proposition that men tend to negotiate more aggressively than women when they negotiate for salaries. And then when women do negotiate for salaries, both men and women are less likely to view that woman favorably for having negotiated. And what that reveals is a sense of gender bias in salary negotiations. And that is what Pao is trying to address in her policy decision. So it does eliminate that advantage, but it does not get at the heart of the issue. It doesn't eliminate the upstream gender bias issue. And it also requires faith that company is actually committed to upholding their end of the bargain and not negotiating with some people and not with others.
Yeah, that's been some of the criticism here. And also people have said, well, if the pay isn't transparent, if we don't know what our colleagues, for example, are getting paid, it doesn't matter if you negotiate or not. We have no idea if the pay is equitable then.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I've gone back and forth on this myself because very clearly there is a gender bias issue, but I'm not sure that this is the best answer to that issue. I think that having an open dialogue and committing to a conversation in the workplace about why gender bias exists and sort of unearthing some of the preconceived notions that people come with to the workplace may help to remediate some of these issues during the salary negotiation process. But certainly, as a business executive, I can tell you that being able to negotiate a salary is a good indication of your ability to negotiate other things in the workplace, and it is a valuable skill.
Well, let's get to some of the basics here. I mean, how big a problem is it in this day and age of inequitable pay between men and women doing, again, the same or comparable work?
You know, that's interesting because there's some debate about that. You know, it's often quoted that women in the U.S. still earn only 77 cents on the dollar compared to men. But when you dig behind that issue, part of the reason for that pay disparity is the fact that women are willing to take jobs that pay less and are willing to take part-time jobs. And if you dig even further, part of the reason for that is that women make certain choices about the way they spend their time in their lives. For better or for worse, they do tend to be the primary caregivers for children, and they are more willing to make compromises in their careers more than their male counterparts, and that's part of what Sheryl Sandberg was getting at in her very famous book. So yes, there is a pay disparity on paper, but I don't think that we've really done the work analytically at getting behind that reported pay disparity and unearthing the reasons why it is what it is.
Talking to Lily Garcia about pay disparities between men and women, and in particular, triggered by one effort to tackle that, the online company Reddit saying they're going to stop negotiating with new hires. Apparently, there's a negotiation advantage for men and a negotiating penalty for women when it comes to getting better salaries. So, Lily, you mentioned different maybe career life work balance issues being a part of the factor in pay disparity. Given that maybe all the research isn't in yet, what else is out there accounting for these disparities?
I believe that's what it is. I don't think that we completely understand sociologically what part of this is a free will decision on the part of a well-informed woman if the direction her career is taking, and what part of this is actually a product of gender bias in the way that decisions in the home are made. We don't completely understand it. So we stand at an important crossroads. And as I thought about this issue, I almost hesitate to make the analogy, but it keeps coming back to me as an apt one. It's a little bit like forced busing of students during desegregation. Do we kind of force these issues and force the outcome that we want and force the playing field to be level? Or do we try to work upstream and get at some of the causes of the issue and try to win the hearts and minds of people and get them to become a little bit more enlightened in how they operate in the workplace?
Now, as you mentioned, and as I just restated there, there's a negotiation penalty for women. A woman will be less successful maybe doing the same things as a man does in negotiating for a salary. What's behind that? Why would two candidates, otherwise more or less equal, be treated differently in that situation?
What is behind that is gender bias, and that is the opportunity for our society to recognize that, to recognize that there are certain qualities that, quite frankly, are very, as I said earlier, very desirable in business for which we do penalize women. And there is absolutely no doubt that we do that. But I'm not sure that the answer, I'm unconvinced, I would say. I'm not sure that the answer is to just eliminate that negotiation advantage. I think that perhaps a more enlightened view might be to just change the way that we do business with the women that we're hiring.
Easy to say, hard to do, I think. What would be first steps toward changing that?
It's diversity training. It's this very, very high-quality diversity training. I know that diversity is a maligned word in this day and age because there are so many forms of diversity training that aren't very intelligent, that are just a band-aid, don't really accomplish the objective. But it really is about getting people to deeply understand their ingrained habits and their perspectives and where they come from, and to come around to appreciating the value. And I don't mean this from an altruistic standpoint, just from a business results standpoint of having people with different perspectives at the table. And if businesses and people in business could simply understand this, then they would be far less inclined to judge people who come from different backgrounds.
Now, this has been a hot issue in the high-tech world, and it's partly hot because the high-tech world gets talked about on social media and online a lot. A lot of people are trying to make this conversation happen. There's been a lot of backlash against the people trying to make this conversation happen. How do we approach these issues in a way that doesn't just devolve into angry comments in a comment section or a Facebook page?
I think it's a little bit like the way Al Gore approached the environmentalist movement, right? It's really understanding, and from his perspective, right, what's good for the environment is good for business. From this perspective, what is good for people, what creates equality, and what creates diversity in the workplace is actually what is good for business. We need a diversity of perspectives at the table. Otherwise, our businesses simply will not remain competitive.
Well, connect the dots there. I think a lot of people hear that, and we've had callers in the past saying, who cares on a committee what the makeup is? As long as they're qualified, as long as they're skilled people, there's going to be a good outcome.
Well, there simply won't. And the research demonstrates, for example, that people who are on a committee who have diverse Myers-Briggs profiles, for example, will come up with more creative and more effective solutions to business problems than people who are on homogenous teams. It's that area of research is sort of, you know, black letter textbook. It's very well established that diversity does produce more creative and better business results.
Now, we're talking about highly skilled, better compensated segments of the labor force here. How about, there's a lot of people in retail jobs, fast food jobs, things like that, where I assume you don't really get to negotiate. You take or leave what they offer you. Do we have a sense of if there's that same kind of gender bias in pay at those levels of the workforce?
There is still a margin for negotiation. In my experience, every job comes with a pay range, even if it's very rigid. Now, at the higher, more executive levels, there is a much broader range, but there is still a budget for that job, and you can negotiate to be at the top of that budget if you know how to play your cards right. And I would, at this point, just default to quoting Jack Welch and saying you want every brain in the game. So even in a very entry-level position, it does advantage your business to seek out diversity of perspectives, because you want to foster an organization where everybody is thinking about improvement in the way that you do business and contributing their ideas.
We were talking to Lily Garcia. She's an employment attorney. She has a lot of experience advising clients in the high tech and education sectors in particular, longtime advice columnist on workplace issues. We're talking about news that the internet company Reddit is going to stop negotiating salaries with its potential hires, the idea that it's going to help close the wage gap for women in that industry. What do you think? Do you think this is a good idea that could help women catch up to men salary-wise? Or is there another way, another road to get that done? Is it fair to men and women? Would getting rid of salary negotiations be better than other approaches? Coaching women maybe to be better, more effective negotiators? Have you negotiated for salary in your work? How'd that turn out for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, the internet company Reddit announced it's going to stop negotiating salaries with their potential hires. They say the negotiation process puts women at a disadvantage. We're talking to Lily Garcia. She's an employment attorney with 2 decades of experience advising clients, mainly in high-tech and education sectors. She says she's not sure this is really going to make that much of a difference when it comes to unequal pay for men and women. What do you think? Is this a good idea that could help women catch up to men salary-wise? Is it fair to both men and women? If you don't like this idea, what might work better? Call 800-642-1234. And if you're a woman in the workplace, you've seen pay inequity. What do you think led to that? What would you like to see change? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Daniel on the line in Milwaukee. Daniel, hi.
How you doing?
What do you think?
I don't think that this, the way the Reddit CEO is approaching this, is a good idea. Only because when you force diversity through special treatment in a workplace, in a place where people commit themselves to succeeding, putting food on the table, planning for retirement, it breeds resentment and it fosters, alienation against, minorities, women in the workplace, all these things that perpetuate these issues. It could be fixed just by, waiting and having, minorities in the workplace is now it's a normal thing in almost every industry, and that happens with time, and it'll happen with women with time. There are numerous female CEOs making tons of money and who are very successful, and as time goes on, it will become more common. But if we force people to accept not being able to argue for a slightly higher salary because some CEO doesn't want to have complaints from women about their pay, they're going to resent the women in the workplace.
Daniel, thanks for the call. A lot there, Lily. Do you think this kind of change or other efforts might provoke more resentment than they solve problems? Lily, oh, we lost Lily Garcia. We'll get her back on the line. In the meantime, you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the idea. Do you see this as a big problem for you? Maybe in your workplace, a place you've worked in the past, a differential pay between men and women. What are the causes? What solutions would you like to see? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can email us, talk@WPR.org. Lily Garcia is back with us. Lily, the gist from the caller there that a change like this, getting rid of negotiations or anything else attempting to sort of by fiat level the playing field, is going to generate a lot of resentment, do that more than actually solve any problems.
You know, I would agree with Daniel that forcing diversity on an organization does breed resentment and alienation, but I really don't feel like this, what Pau is suggesting, is very forceful. I think what she's saying is, and it's actually, if you read between the lines, very much advantageous to her business. I mean, she's been criticized for paying below market salaries. What she's saying is, hey, listen, I'm not going to negotiate with anybody. And by the way, the reason that I'm doing this is because women have a negotiation disadvantage in the hiring process. So I'm just not going to do that. But what it does is create an advantage for her organization.
Thanks for the call, Daniel. Before we get back to callers, Lily, if we can venture into a little advice. If there's a woman out there maybe starting a new job, she's heard about this negotiation penalty where she might actually be looked down on for negotiating for salary. So what's she supposed to do?
I'm so glad you brought that up, Rob, because that is where the change begins to happen. It's similar to what Daniel was discussing. Change happens over time. If women give up on negotiating, change is never going to happen. The only way it's going to happen is when women negotiating for the salaries they deserve becomes a commonplace practice. So commonplace, in fact, that nobody would expect them to do anything differently. And that is when the bias is going to start to fall away.
Go back to our callers. We've got John on the line in Beloit. John, hi.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. Historically, corporations were designed to build bridges, canals, things like that, things that actually bettered our nation as a whole. Today, they do not. I think it'd be better if corporations in general had set structured pay ranges like the GS system for the federal government. I'm not saying they should have everything, but that way everything's already laid out. It's a corporation. They're not a private. I mean, they're a corporation. They're created by the government. If that, otherwise, they don't benefit the whole nation as a whole. And then you have CEO salaries in hundreds of millions of dollars and so forth. And it kind of throws it all out of balance. But if it was a private company, they should be able to do anything they want. But then they hold all the liability to themselves, and it creates a difference. I'll take your comment off the air.
Wait, John, I just want to be clear. You're saying if it's a publicly traded corporation, publicly licensed corporation, there should be government guidelines on pay ranges?
Yeah, because they're created by the government. That's the reason. I mean, how do you think a corporation came to be?
Gotcha. John, I just wanted to clarify that point. So, Lily, whether it came from the government or from a corporation itself, a set pay structure right out there, out front, not behind closed doors negotiations, is that a possible alternative here?
I think if a company is if they're kind of at the top of their S curve and they're really trying to do something groundbreaking and innovative, they're going to have to abandon any kind of set pay structure, because what they're going to want to do is disproportionately reward first those positions that are most strategically valuable to that organization, and secondly the people who are the top performers in those positions. That's the way they're going to create that strategic advantage for the organization and creating the new S-curve and getting them into a position of competitive advantage. So maybe for an organization that isn't there yet, that is sort of in the middle of the S-curve, a pay scale will work, and certainly that brings a lot of stability and predictability to the operations of the business. But there does come a point at which the organization will need to break away from that.
Quick definition, Lily. S-curve. I don't know that one.
An S-curve,
in a nutshell.
So when a company is at the beginning of any sort of cycle, and usually it's a cycle of innovation, they're at the bottom of a curve. You plot that along a graph, right? And then the curve kind of goes up in the shape of an S and then levels out at the top. And if the company wishes to remain competitive in their field, they're going to have to create a new S-curve to layer on top of that one to create more lift for the organization. Otherwise, what the S will do is ultimately, if you follow my visual, it will trend down.
Aha. Okay, and they don't want that. Well, a minute ago, I asked you for advice for a woman in the situation of getting a new job and negotiating. You said women should continue to negotiate until it becomes commonplace. Let's flip it around. From the corporate culture side of things, knowing that studies have shown, as you say, there is a bias against women who negotiate. Maybe there's a business leader listening. What do you suggest to them to change things, to look at a negotiation from a man and a woman more or less equally?
I would just say, change starts with you. That is the locus of the change that we're seeking. So keep an open mind and evaluate every candidate on the merits, and don't allow your personal biases regarding what kind of negotiation behavior is appropriate or inappropriate for a man or a woman come into play when it comes to hiring decisions. Not only because it's morally wrong, but because it doesn't make any sense for the business. You really should be hiring the most qualified person for the job and not just the person who you like the most.
I want to look at long-term trends. We heard earlier from our caller, Daniel, who said, hey, it's going to take time. We're seeing improvements. Women will eventually achieve something at parity or something close to it in the workforce. Is that the trend, A, and is it happening quickly? Because if you're a woman in the workforce now, hearing that it's going to happen eventually may not be of great comfort.
I'm kind of with Daniel, with the caveat that I am an eternal optimist. I am a child of the 70s, and I saw my mother struggle as an executive in the media industry and everything that she had to endure. And I can tell you, and you couldn't tell this on the radio, but I'm not only a woman, but I'm also a minority. And my pathway has been a lot smoother than hers was. And so I can tell you from just anecdotal experience that things have gotten easier, and I believe that they will. And maybe it won't be as quickly as some people would like, but I believe that it is trending in a positive direction.
Bringing it back to our starting point here with the company Reddit and Ellen Pao doing this thing, trying to get rid of negotiations to balance things out. You're not sure this idea will work. Do you think, though, that it's getting the conversation going in a positive way?
It is. And I have to commend Pao because she has really stepped out and taken a bold position on this issue. And I think it started an important conversation.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Lily, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
That's Lily Garcia. She's an employment attorney. We've been talking about the company Reddit's announcement that it will end salary negotiations in an effort to end the pay gap between men and women. You can still share your thoughts, by the way. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. And while you're there, remember it's International Haiku Day. Maybe give us a seasonal Wisconsin-oriented haiku. That's Twitter at Central Time WPR. Stick around. There's more to come. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.